This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When writer Deidre Baer finished her biography of Samuel Beckett, she began searching for a subject for her next book. She wanted to write about a woman who had managed to achieve a stimulating professional life while also maintaining a satisfying personal life. When the idea of Simone de Beauvoir came up, Baer says it was like a light bulb flashed above her head. Beauvoir was one of the most free-spirited and unconventional women of her time. Her groundbreaking book, The Second Sex, played a major role in creating the current feminist movement. Beauvoir wrote many other essays and novels while carrying on a lifelong relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre. Beauvoir agreed to meet with Baer, and they conducted regular interviews during the last 6 years of Beauvoir's life until her death in 1986. The biography has now been published, and Deidre Baer spoke with Terry Gross about what had drawn her to Simone de Beauvoir in the first place.
This was the woman who, according to popular belief and according to her own four volumes of memoirs, this was the woman who had had the perfect relationship and who had also had significant influence on the way women think about themselves throughout most of the world. So I thought this would be someone really worth writing about. And that's what I believed in the beginning. I believed that she had had the perfect relationship and the perfect life.
And when you, by the time you completed the book, did you still believe she had the perfect relationship and the perfect life?
No, I didn't think that. I thought that along the way she had made many bad choices, and particularly in her relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre, who was her companion for more than 50 years. I questioned her choices. I spoke to her about this. As you know, I spent the greater part of the last 6 years of her life in conversation with her about her life and work. And she, though, believed that she had always made the right choices. She defended them until she died. She believed in the sanctity of her relationship with Sartre, the holiness of it. It became an icon for her, a beacon, whatever one wants to call it, the fixed point in her world. And for her, she truly believed that she had had a happy life and a happy relationship.
Well, she met Sartre when they were both students.
Yes.
They became lovers, but they rejected the idea of marriage. Why didn't she want to get married?
Because he didn't want to get married.
You think she would have gotten married if he wanted to get married?
I think so. She always took her lead from him. And he was the one who came up with the idea of contingent relationship, that they would be important to each other. They would sign a pact, a two-year pact, and each would be the important person in this pact for the other throughout those 2 years. And if at the end of 2 years they decided that they wanted to renew it, they would for varying degrees of time. After a while, after about 4 or 5 years, they stopped renewing the pact, except perhaps with a ceremonial glass of wine to say, well, you know, we'll keep on, shall we? And, of course, they did.
What did the pact say?
The pact was a verbal pact. She talks about it in her memoirs. She said that one day they had gone to the movies, and they were sitting in a park in Paris, and they were talking, and Sartre was explaining how each would be the most important person for the other, but that if each of them wanted to experience other relationships, either physical or emotional, with other people, that each should be free to do so, and that theirs would be a pact of perfect honesty. If one of the two were to sleep with someone else, they would tell the other person, and they would discuss it in detail, almost as an intellectual exercise rather than something emotional that had happened in their lives.
Sartre wanted this pact where they could have outside relationships. Well, he had quite a sexual appetite, and he had so many women that he had relationships with. How did Simone de Beauvoir cope with jealousy? I mean, their pact was based in part on an intellectual belief, but then you had to deal with your emotions, which aren't always controlled by the intellect.
Well, she claimed that she never worried too much about these other women, and My belief is that she didn't worry about them because they weren't his intellectual equals. People would say to me in Paris that people who knew them well throughout their lifetime, that she was the only woman who could follow him mentally, intellectually, that his mind was this marvel of leaping, darting, visionary thinking, and that hers was quick enough not only to follow what he had to say, but to argue, to contradict, to suggest other directions of thought, and that the two of them together made a perfect whole. Colette Audry, an old friend of Simone de Beauvoir, said that sometimes when you saw them together and you saw the intensity of what they had with each other, it made you very sad that you yourself didn't have this. So with these other women, they were sexual playthings. They were amusing diversions. They were not Sartre's intellectual equal. Sartre said many times that he really enjoyed the company of women because one could be oneself with them, whereas when he was in the company of men, they all expected him to conduct intelligent conversations or to discuss philosophy or to speak about political situations in the world. And he said, and with men, there's always a kind of macho competition. With women, he could relax and he could be himself. And so Simone de Beauvoir gradually came to believe that these diversions, these playthings and toys, were good for him, and she went along with it. In a number of instances, she actually tried to persuade young women that they should allow themselves to become Sartre's sexual companions.
There's something very sexist sounding about her attitude.
It certainly is. It's a masculine attitude, really. It's certainly a non-feminist attitude from someone who wrote The Second Sex, that, you know, that women are playthings or toys to be given to this man as he desired them. But again, that's almost too simple and too easy. You know, my book is 700 pages, and on every single page from 1929, when Beauvoir met Sartre, there is some discussion or attempt at explanation of the complexity of their relationship. To put it onto a simple relationship of sexual playthings, for example, with the women really isn't quite fair. There's much more to be said.
After around 8 or 10 years, Beauvoir's relationship with Sartre ceased being sexual, but they remained very close. And throughout her life, she followed him in a way, followed him on his travels, followed him in part intellectually. Does it contradict her views as a feminist? Does it contradict her views as someone who believed in equality in a relationship to have placed Sartre's intellect and needs in a way above her own?
I think so, yes. And I did talk to her about that many different times. Sometimes it would make her so angry that she'd say, this interview is over, you know, you're leaving, and I don't know when and if we'll ever talk again, but of course we always did continue to talk. At other times, she'd pound her fist angrily on the table and she'd say, listen, this is my life. I wrote The Second Sex. I made my feminist statement, and I'm living my life the way I want to live it. I can't help it if feminist women don't like the choices I made. I made the choices that are right for me. And the choices that she made, of course, were always to put Sartre first. For example, he died in 1980, and from 1980 to 1986, she spent most of her time trying to put his manuscripts in order, doing nothing with her own papers, her own writings, anything that related to Sartre's long and varied career that she could assist with, she did. She did that even at the same time as many, many women were coming to her and asking her if they might write about her work in various ways, either as intellectual histories or feminist tracts or whatever. She'd say, no, it's not important. I'm working on Sartre today. Can't see you. And she wouldn't. In terms of how she lived her life, she claimed, and evidence bears out, the fact that she really was not very political. She didn't really believe in politics. She didn't have a credo of her own. She really followed him when he'd say, we have to support such and such a cause. We have to take part in such and such a demonstration. We have to go to such and such a country to support the revolutionaries there. She did it. Her letters time and again say, well, I don't really want to do this, but Sartre wants me to, so I have to do it.
My guest Deirdre Baer is the author of a new biography of Simone de Beauvoir, and her previous biography was about Samuel Beckett. Beauvoir had a 17-year relationship with the Chicago-based writer Nelson Algren, and among other things, he wrote The Man with the Golden Arm. She described him as the only true passionate love of my life.
Yes.
How did her passion for him compare to her passion for Sartre?
Well, by the time she met Algren, she had almost fixed in her mind the idea of herself and Sartre as the permanent couple, what I call in the book the myth of the professional couple. She had carved out a niche for herself in Parisian society, and it's very important to keep that always in mind. I try to focus on life in Paris almost as much as I focus on the life of Simone de Beauvoir in Paris, because she had evolved from a very rigid and closed society in which she was brought up to become one of the most notorious women in France. So it's important to understand the rigidity from which she came to the freedom with which her relationship with Sartre allowed her. And then you see her as his companion. As she said, for many, many years, she didn't realize that she was discriminated against because she was a privileged woman who, because she was Sartre's companion, was admitted everywhere and accepted everywhere. So that finally, the idea of them as a couple, the myth of the professional couple, became so strong. And the pleasure of her life in Paris, the pleasure of being able to go into any intellectual circle and to be accepted and indeed respected by the time she met Algren, which was 1948-1949, she had a very, very rich and full and good life in Paris. She came to the United States to tour colleges and universities for the French government, and she was their representative to give these lectures. She went to Chicago, perfectly ordinary lecture, and met this man and was, and in her words, bowled over the moon by him. The interesting thing for me is they became lovers immediately, the first night they met, actually. He took her to see the underside of Chicago, which he liked, which he needed. It was necessary for him, for the way he wrote, for his vision. He took her to see criminals and pimps and dance halls and druggies and all sorts of things that absolutely fascinated her. She always had a taste for the underside of life. Throughout the relationship, if you read the correspondence between Algren and Beauvoir, you see that it was not only a relationship of passion, but it was also a relationship of intellectual equals. Well, then, the next logical question is, why didn't she stay with this man who gave her all of the intellectual companionship and equality that she got with Sartre, but who also gave her a glorious physical relationship, a glorious emotional relationship, someone who wanted to marry her, be with her permanently, have children with her. Her reasoning was, and this is, I think, a very sound reasoning, that she was a French writer, and she could only write about French subjects in the French language. Were she to move to Chicago, she would be removed from the necessary materials that she needed to continue her creative existence. On the other hand, if he were to go to Paris, the same thing would happen to him. So it became a kind of a stalemate. They tried to work it out, and gradually it dissipated. They just weren't able to conduct a long-distance relationship.
She had said that it was thinking about her relationships with Sartre and with Nelson Algren that made her want to write about women in heterosexual relationships. When she wrote The Second Sex, did Sartre and Algren support her ideas in the book?
Algren didn't. He made jokes about it. He said, you know, she wrote this wonderful book and that's fine, but when she's here with me in the bedroom, I am the boss, or words to that effect. He wrote some funny letters to some of his friends. Sartre didn't matter one way or the other, because by this time Sartre was so involved in his own work that he was delighted for her success. This is the interesting thing about Sartre, that he really was not a jealous person. He was absolutely thrilled for her success. But her success left him free to go on and do what he wanted to do.
Well, how did she deal with Nelson Algren thinking that, you know, to say this in a book is one thing, but when we're alone together, I'm the man.
The man is
the dominating factor.
She behaved that way when she was with him. She called herself his frog wife, and she called him her local youth or her crocodile. And she took on all the feminine, usual, what we think of as the usual feminine attributes and characteristics when she was with him. She'd talk about, here I am trying to cook, I who know nothing, or here I am making a bed or doing all of these sorts of things for him.
Do you see that as a lack of ability to follow into practice what you've put into theory? Or do you think that people just are what they are?
I see it as the complexity of human relationships. I mean, you know, just because she wrote a feminist book, does that mean that her life has to be a feminist polemic? People are complicated individuals, and we do things in relationships, in the privacy of our relationships, that we might not want to be known in terms of our public persona. And that's it with her. She said, you know, look, I'm living my life. I write these books, and they're important to me, but I'm living my life. I have to say that I really respect her for having defined on her terms what she wanted life to be, and for having the strength of will, and it really was will, to live that life. May not have been the life I would have chosen or you would have chosen, but it was her life.
The most important relationship of the latter years of her life was with a woman named Sylvie Le Bon, who was 30 years younger than Beauvoir was. Had Le Bon been her student?
No, not really. Le Bon was a philosophy student in Paris, and she met Beauvoir. She was very, very influenced by Beauvoir's philosophical essays as well as The Second Sex. And she, like many young women, presented herself before Simone de Beauvoir and said, you know, you're my idol, my model. I'd like to be your friend. And the friendship gradually blossomed until they became companions.
You said that there were many lesbians and feminists who assumed that this was a gay relationship between Beauvoir and Le Bon, and many women pressured Beauvoir to come out and make a public statement.
Yes.
About being a lesbian. What was Beauvoir's reaction to that?
I think that it goes back to this childhood, this rigidly repressed childhood that she had. All her life, she made denigrating remarks about homosexuals, lesbians and male homosexuals. She decried homosexuality. She made bitter, vicious jokes about it. Friends of hers, homosexual friends of hers, she treated them terribly in her correspondence when she was describing them. I talked to her at great length about homosexuality, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote the chapter on her relationship with Sylvie the way I did. Beauvoir believed that a woman could kiss another woman on the lips, could fondle another woman's breasts, could hug, could be embraced by a woman. But for her, sex involved genital penetration. And she insisted that she was not a lesbian because she had never had genital involvement with a woman. It came down to that very, very fine point. I didn't say that in the book. I thought it was self-evident from the way I wrote that chapter. But I must say that again and again, people are asking me to describe this relationship more explicitly. And so I'm simply saying what Simone de Beauvoir told me. This may not satisfy either lesbians or heterosexuals, but it's what the woman believed. I can only report what she believed.
So in other words, they did have a relationship that involved kissing.
Yes, they had a physical relationship. They frequently shared the same bed when they traveled. They asked for a double bed in a hotel room. But Beauvoir insisted they were not lesbians. As a matter of fact, the last afternoon that I was with her before she died, we were having this pleasant conversation, and suddenly she turned to me and she said, "You're going to say in this book that Sylvie and I are lesbians." And it caught me by surprise because it came out of nowhere. And she said several feminist women in Paris had told her that I was going to flat out call them lesbians. And I said, "No, I'm not going to do this because your relationship with Sylvie, as you have defined it, is not a lesbian relationship. I'm going to discuss your intimacy with this woman, but I'm not going to flat out call you a lesbian because you don't believe that you are one." And she said, "Yes, I think that's the appropriate way to say it." And so that's the way I wrote it.
Did she resent the pressure that was put on her to make a public statement about her sexuality?
Yes, of course. She resented very much the interest in her personal life and in her relationships. She wanted people to focus on the work. And I must tell you, you know, I wrote this 700-page biography. I describe in the preface how I was on a panel at Harvard with one of Sartre's biographers. At the end of the program, every question asked about Sartre concerned his work. Every question asked about Simone de Beauvoir concerned her sex life. And I find pretty much that this is what really interests people in this book that I wrote. It's the question of her relationships much, much more than the question of her work.
And I feel like I need to address that since I've prepared an interview that really is about her relationships.
Yes.
And I have a reason for that, and that's as someone who read The Second Sex at a kind of pivotal point in my development, I really want to know how a woman who came up with such an original way of thinking about women and about women's relationships with men, how she lived her own life, especially how she lived it at a time, you know, before she didn't have The Second Sex to look to help understand male-female relationships or to help understand why woman has been perceived as the other. She had nobody to articulate that for her. So what kind of life did she live? I'm just so curious about that.
By the questions that you've defined, she lived a non-feminist life. She lived a totally non-feminist life in the shadow of Jean-Paul Sartre.
See, that's what I find fascinating.
Yes, it is. It is. It's absolutely astonishing. And the other thing is that I find now that a number of feminists are attacking me for having written the book showing the reality of her life. It's, in other words, I call it killing the messenger. You kill the messenger who brings you the bad news, which I find astonishing. You know, I'm presenting the way the woman lived her life. I'm not superimposing a thesis or a theory on it. I'm just showing how it was. And I'm sorry that people are disappointed. I was disappointed. But nevertheless, it was the life, and I had to write it the way she lived it.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us about Beauvoir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Deirdre Beer's biography of Simone de Beauvoir has just been published by Summit Books, and her biography of Samuel Beckett has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.